Can you tell me about the genesis of the book? How did it come about?
I would say 14 years of frustration is basically it. It's very difficult to win this argument with sound bites because the other side is covered with white coats and authority. And so for years they've kept dentists, doctors, scientists, and the media away from the details of the issue, away from the literature, and in place of science, they're able to substitute endorsements, quote, authority, and also able to denigrate opponents as junk scientists, etc. So it's very difficult in newspaper articles and editorials to get the arguments out. You seldom get enough space to do that. And for many citizens, will just more or less accept the authority of these bodies and not pursue the science. So I wanted to write a book that put everything I knew between two covers of a book, and I was fortunate enough to get help from two other scientists to do that. So it's out there, you know. I've got it out of my system, and anybody that is prepared to read it will see how foolish this practice is and why it needs to be stopped.
What were your roles and your co-authors' roles in putting the book together?
Well, I started it. I started the writing the book, and they had, both James and Spedding, had been giving me input as we went along. I was sharing the various chapters with people, asking for their suggestions and help. And they, in particular, were coming through with pretty solid suggestions. And after a while, I said to them, well, no, you're helping me so much with this. Would you like to be co-authors? And their first response was, no, 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 it's your book. Go up, go ahead with it. And I said, no, it'd be very helpful to have three of us doing it. Because I said, no, if it's just my name on it, they'll find a way of putting me into a box and then throwing the box away. That's a typical way, you know, I'm just the one crazy person out there that's opposed to fluoridation. And you get rid of Connett and you get rid of the argument. I said, they're going to have to find it very difficult. If there's three of us, one from Canada, one from Scotland, and one from the United States, one a biologist, one a chemist, one a physicist. And it's going to be tough for them. And eventually I was able to persuade them that they would co-author it. And then there was dramatic change. Once they took on the co-authorship responsibility, then they really dug into the book and made real major, major changes. I mean, in terms of even eliminating chapters, rewriting chapters, and they really then did become co-authors of the book, and a much better book as a consequence.
What's your personal history with fluoride research? When did you become interested in this
14
topic?
14 years ago. I didn't want this issue, Jeff. I didn't want it. And it came about by almost by accident. I should give you my history is that I taught chemistry full-time at St. Lawrence University. And 25 years ago, whilst in about the second year I was teaching there, I got involved with waste management issues because they wanted to build a municipal waste incinerator in our county. And I got involved in that issue, realized that that was a mistake, and started to campaign against that particular incinerator. And to cut a long story short, that involvement, fighting incinerators and promoting the alternatives, led me all over the world. I mean, 49 states in the United States and 53 other countries in total over the last 25 years. And at that time, 14 years ago, I was occupied on that issue nearly every weekend and nearly every holiday, every break in my semesters. I was going somewhere around the world working on this issue. And it was tough at times to balance the demands of a full-time chemistry professorship on the one hand and meeting this global demand on waste management on the other. So when my wife dumped a whole bunch of papers on my desk one afternoon in July of 1996 and said, dear, would you read these papers? I said, what is it? What's it about? She says, fluoridation. I said, take it away. These people are crazy. So I didn't want a third issue. My time was mortgaged to the hilt.
Was this,
I certainly didn't want this one, which was stigmatized, as you know, as the province of a bunch of Flat Earth Society crazy people, and I'd succumbed to that same notion. Without doing any research, you take that prevailing notion. And so when I started to read the papers that she put there, my intention was as quickly as possible to find out where these crazy anti-fluoridationists had made some fundamental scientific mistakes, and there was nothing to worry about. I thought, as I embarked upon the exercise, that I would quickly find out that the anti-fluoridation people had confused fluorine with fluoride, which is akin to confusing chlorine with sodium with salt. But they hadn't made that mistake, and it didn't take me long to realize that there were some very serious problems with that practice. And then the reason that my wife asked me to look at these materials was because that evening, the village board, our little village of Canton, was considering whether they were going to continue the practice or not. And I remember saying to her, walking to the village board meeting, I said, Ellen, this is going to be easy. When they hear what I read this afternoon, there's no way they're going to continue fluoridation. And, of course, then I got my first shock, and that is that all the dentists and several doctors were lined up to give their complete, utter, confident assurance that this was the best thing since sliced bread. It was perfectly safe. And people were saying things like, well, I'm not a scientist, but I trust my dentist. My dentist tells me it's okay. Therefore, it's okay. I'll go along with it. And other people saying, well, one woman said, I've just had a baby, and I asked my doctor if it was okay, and he said it was fine, so I'm going along with it. And then we creamed that night, that there's no way they're going to stop it based upon this phalanx of the medical and dental community telling them it's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Well, afterwards, I went up to one of the doctors, and I said, would you read these three papers? And he said, I don't have time to do that. Well, I said, that's not very responsible. I said, you just heard these people saying that the reason they're going along with this is because their doctors have told them it's safe. He says, well, I don't have time to read up on everything that comes across my desk. And I said, I quite understand that. You know, don't get me wrong. I don't expect you to be an expert in every subject that pertains to medicine. I said, but you shouldn't let these people believe that you've read the literature and it's your professional judgment that this is perfectly okay, when that's obviously not the case. And at that point, my wife is pulling me away because I'm getting a bit heated. But, you know, that discussion on that night was a microcosm of what I was to see for the next 14 years, that local, state, and federal officials will go onto public platforms and make these absolutely 150% confident statements that fluoridation is perfectly safe and perfectly effective. And it's almost to the point that they get some kind of commission every time they use the word safe and effective. It's like a mantra, safe and effective, safe and effective. And they haven't read the literature. They haven't read it. And if they were to do so, they'd be utterly shocked at the way they've been corralled into supporting this nonsense.
So prior to this, did you support fluoridation, or had you not considered it as an issue?
I had been asked by two or three people out there. I remember somebody in Spokane, when I was talking against the incinerator in Spokane, asked me to look at the fluoridation issue, and I said, you know, I just don't have time for another issue. I remember someone in Ontario asking me the same thing. And again, I more or less have said the same thing. And somebody else in East Liverpool, Ohio, asking me. So the three different people asked me if I would get involved in this issue. And each time I begged off by saying I didn't have time because of the waste, because involvement in the waste issue. And also at the back of my mind was that, you know, people already thought it was a bit crazy opposing incineration and thinking that dioxin was a problem. I think both positions have since been thoroughly vindicated. But at the time, you know, people treated people, again, a little suspect if they thought that dioxin, which is very, very nasty for practically every animal that's ever been exposed to, was somehow okay for human beings. That position was quite a difficult one to hold on to in the 80s when I started. But, anyway, I didn't want... then this, I think, also applies to many people in the environmental movement, that they're already, many of them are perceived to being a little close to the edge, and they won't take, they won't touch fluoridation because they feel that that, in the public's eye, will push them over the edge as being less than intelligent, less than balanced, less than whatever.
Yours isn't the first book opposing fluoridation. What information or perspectives were lacking in the previous anti-fluoridation literature?
I think the simple answer is it comes out after the National Research Council report of 2006, and that was 507 pages, 1,100 references, largely ignored, downplayed by the promoters in every country, and after a little bit of attention, essentially downplayed, ignored by the media. So I think that our book coming after that report is very important. We've attempted to put into layman's language a lot of the analysis that had come out of that report. So that I think that the simplest way of putting this is, the thing that's unique at this point, the thing that was unique was the National Research Council report. For the first time in the whole history of this, at that time 50-plus years, it was the first time that any blue-ribbon American panel had been balanced that looked at the fluoride's toxicity. It was a truly balanced panel. They had pro- and anti-fluoridation people on the panel, and they had most of them were had not taken a position. But it was balanced, and they set out to get a balanced panel. And as a result, we got the first real decent review of the literature. And it was dismissed on the day by the American Dental Association. I mean, how on earth the ADA could have read 507 pages, digested them, and absorbed some of the 1,100 references, and done an instantaneous health risk assessment to determine a new safe drinking water standard is beyond me. How anybody could treat that organization with any seriousness on a scientific level is amazing. But they do. I mean, they still treat the ADA as if it's some kind of scientific body rather than a trade association desperately trying to protect itself against lawsuits, which you can see so obviously with mercury amalgams and maybe now with dental x-rays. But it's the same, you know, the trajectory is the same, the rhetoric is the same, there's no solid science that demonstrates any problem, blah, 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 blah. But anyway, I mean, just to go back a couple of sentences, what the National Research Council report did was to say that the safe drinking water standard ain't safe, that you should do, that the EPA should do a new health risk assessment and determine a new MCLG. Now, there's two things here which is sometimes confuses people. You've got the standard, the federally enforced standard, which is called the maximum contaminant level,
which is four
parts per million.
Right.
But you've also got something else which is important, and that's the MCLG, the maximum contaminant level goal. And that's not a standard. That is literally a goal. And that goal is established using the best science that's available in terms of endpoints and the best scientific judgment in terms of margins of safety needed to protect everyone from drinking uncontrolled amounts of water, which in itself is a difficult thing to do. And that, too, is set at 4 parts per million. Now, what the EPA, what the NRC was saying to the EPA is determine a new MCLG. The MCL comes later. Once you've determined the MCLG, what is the best level that's protective of everyone's health? Once you've determined that, then the MCL is determined by a compromise, which is you have to look at how much it's going to cost to remove fluoride down to that level.
Right, and your hope was that, or the hope of the panel, I think your hope is that the MCLG would be zero.
Yeah, I think it should be zero. And that's because if you apply an appropriate margin of safety to known endpoints, then you would see that we're already over that safe level before you've added a speck to the drinking water.
To kind of go over the basic concepts of the book, as I in the most basic formulation, I see three basic arguments of the book, and I would like you to see if I'm missing any, first of all, and see if I'm misstating any of them. Okay, so the first one is that it's bad medicine because it's given to all without a doctor consultation, without informed consent, without control of the dose or the dosage, and it's systemic rather than topical.
Absolutely. Got it. Nail on the head. You're okay. Absolutely right.
So yeah. The second basic concept is that there's little or no evidence of its effectiveness for its stated purpose.
For ingested as opposed to topical treatment.
Right.
Yes.
And
yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Then the third is that fluoride, as administered through the public water supply, can cause health problems.
Yeah, and there's a fourth one, and basically the whole promotion, the whole history of the exercise, and the whole promotion of the exercise has lacked scientific rigor from the word go, from 1945 onwards, or if you like 1950, when the U.S. Public Health Service first endorsed fluoridation. It lacked that position lacked. Scientific rigor, and once it was endorsed, then in fact they've worked backwards. The practice became almost sacred, a done deal, and therefore anything that got in the way was either dismissed, ignored, downplayed, or whatever. So they work backwards now. So if any study comes out showing harm, then it must be junk science. It must be junk science because the practice is now anointed. It's policy. You know, policy is king.
Right, because fluoridation is a priori, safe and effective. Therefore, anything showing that it's not that is either not safe or not effective is junk science.
It's junk science. It's the people that are doing it.
It's airtight logic, right?
Yeah. No, that's it. You got it. Those are the four things in the book.
A lot of the philosophical argument against fluoridation is that it's a drug. Make your case that it's a drug rather than nutrient.
Well, it's easy to make the negative, but there's absolutely no evidence that fluoride is any kind of nutrient. And in fact, the moment you start talking about the predominant benefit of fluoride is topical, then any notion of a nutrient is out of the window anyway, because there's no nutrient that I'm aware of that works topically. A nutrient is, by definition, something that you ingest to change some bodily function of some kind. And of course, we know that of the two things that they can't deny, dental fluorosis and dental caries, we know that dental fluorosis is a systemic effect, but it's by no means a benefit, whereas the benefit apparently is, even they are now conceding that it's topical. But no, it's in order to demonstrate that something is a nutrient, you have to deprive the animal, usually an animal, of the so-called or suspected nutrient completely from the diet. And if it is an essential nutrient, like a mineral, like a vitamin, then some disease will accrue. And if a disease does accrue because you starve the animal of that substance, then you turn around and say it's nutrient. Now, they've never done that.
If it's not a nutrient, must it be a drug?
Well, the stated, if you look at the definitions from Europe and elsewhere, something that is used to prevent disease, whether or not it's effective or not, if that is the intention, that it's designed to prevent a disease, in this case tooth decay, then it is a drug, by definition.
Could reasonable people disagree with the assertion that fluoride is a drug?
Only if they're not acquainted with the English dictionary, the English language. I mean, I don't see how they can. They blabber on about it being naturally occurring and all this business, but lots of things naturally occur. That doesn't make them a safe. It doesn't make them a nutrient. Arsenic is naturally occurs. So all that natural occurrence business doesn't wash. And then if you're going to make a big thing about natural levels in water, surface water, groundwater, etc., then what about the most important natural level, which is the level in mother's milk, which is remarkably low? In fact, that was, to me, Jeff, that was the single most important fact that I learned 14 years ago. When I saw the level in mother's milk, I said, whoops, what are you saying here? That Mother Nature screwed up? That evolution got it wrong? That we don't know what the baby's first... That nature got it wrong as to what the baby's first meal should be? That we need to add fluoride to the baby at 250 times the level that it occurs in mother's milk? No way. I think that's so unlikely a proposition that nature had somehow screwed up on that. So that was very influential for me. And I think it's interesting now that we've got to the point where even the ADA and the CDC are, although they're saying it in very mealy-mouthed terms, they are saying that the baby should not get, you know, a bottle-fed baby shouldn't, you shouldn't use tap water. Mm-hmm. Because they now know that the first year is the most vulnerable year for exposure to fluoride and developing of dental fluorosis. And they know from the NRC report that the bottle-fed baby, because of its size and so on, is getting far too much fluoride.
You argue that proponents of fluoridation essentially spin or ignore evidence that undermines their case. You're going to run up against the same thing with your book, right? Won't skeptics make the same charge?
Well, they will try, and that's, they will try. We tried to, wherever we possibly could, acknowledge different points of view, how they would interpret it. I think you can find that in several places, how they view dental fluorosis, how we view dental fluorosis, how they handle the Lee study on hip fractures, how they've handled the IQ studies and so on. But clearly, I mean, we make it clear that we've read the literature, we think it's a bad idea, and we're explaining why we think it's a bad idea. And I think that they've had almost a free ride up to now of getting their arguments across to the public and to the media. And by and large, they've just got away with murder. But anyway, they've had a free ride, more or less, hitherto. And as far as, satisfying the most pure academic here, then what I think should happen now is that given in a year's time, we should see a book which is the case for fluoride, where they do their damnedest now to destroy every argument, either agree with or disagree with every argument in our book, and to document it as thoroughly as we have. And in that wash, then, you will see if we've, if we've been highly selective in the literature that we've chosen. Remember, our task is to show that there are flaws in this practice. Our task is, if you like, we have a slightly easier task than they do. I've sometimes used the analogy that fluoridation is like building a dam above a village. Now, if a villager says, "I think I see a crack in your dam," it's not enough to say, "Oh, you're just a peasant," or "You're just a school teacher," or "You're just a farmer. You're not an expert on dams, and therefore we're going to ignore what you say." No, they have to respond to every flaw that we've seen in their dam structure, and they are the ones that are supposed to be on top, completely on top of this practice. This is something that they're forcing on us. We are not forcing it on them. It's they, the ADA and the CDC in particular, who are insistent to the point of supporting mandatory fluoridation, where people don't even get a chance to vote on it, forcing this on people. And with supreme, and I would say arrogant, confidence in this practice. It is their job, if they're so darn good and so confident at this, that they should be able to answer easily every argument that we've thrown at them. And we've thrown at them as many arguments as we could, and now we wait their reply.
Do you believe that there are no benefits to fluoridation, or that they just haven't been, or that there haven't been any that have been proved that are significant benefits?
I don't think the notion that swallowing fluoride decreases tooth decay has been demonstrated rigorously from a scientific point of view. There have never been any double-blind randomized clinical trials, the kind of thing that the FDA would insist upon if it actually did its job and investigated fluoride as a drug. At the moment, it's classified as an unapproved drug by the FDA. Why on earth they should tolerate an unapproved drug going to over 180 million Americans every day is beyond me, but you know, this is one of those things, you know, these agencies are allowed to get away with such contradictions as long as they have the power. Again, another reason for the book. I mean, it's you take information, you try to take truth to power. So, as far as benefits are concerned, the only benefit that they've claimed, that most people claim, there are one or two that claim that it hardens bones, and who've actually held out the hope that it will reduce hip fractures, reduce bone fractures. But almost for every study that sort of intimates that it might be reducing bone fractures, there's another one which suggests that it's increasing bone fractures, and particularly hip fractures. But anyway, do I believe that these benefits could possibly outweigh all the risks that have been identified? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And if this practice was being entertained today, there's no way on God's earth that they could get away with it. Not today. Absolutely not. As far as the benefits are concerned, what is very clear today is that when you look at tooth decay in large populations, you cannot... let's say for sake of argument, Jeff, that there is a small benefit from ingesting fluoride. It doesn't rise above the background noise.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things, certain factors do rise above the background noise, one of them being income levels, and possibly other things like diet. And it may turn out that vitamin D levels are a factor, and therefore sunshine may be a factor in tooth decay. But when you look at large population studies, it just doesn't rise above the noise.
Much of the evidence for supporting fluoridation is that apparent correlation between fluoridation and the decline in dental caries over decades. Is it hard to explain to people, a lay audience, the difference between correlation and causation?
Oh, absolutely. And someone needs to teach the CDC that. In that infamous 1999 report from the CDC, which underpins their claim that fluoridation is one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century, is a single graph. And that single graph shows tooth decay coming down in 12-year-olds from the 60s to the 90s. And on the same graph, they have the percentage of the population drinking fluoridated water going up by about 15%. And voila! One is coming down because there's others coming up, which is absolutely absurd when you know that those same declines in tooth decay have been happening in all, nearly every single industrialized country, most of which are not fluoridated. So to pull out this one possible factor, which is the percentage of the population drinking fluoridated water as being the causative agent, is absolutely absurd. And if in fact the CDC authors of that report were aware of the World Health Organization data for 12-year-olds, which is, the World Health Organization does track the level of tooth decay in 12-year-olds across the world, and they publish the data. Now, if the CDC authors were aware that the World Health Organization was plotting the same data as they were plotting on that graph, and therefore produce this graph with the implication that the reason it's coming down is because the percentage of the population drinking fluoridated water is going up. If they were aware of that data, that was clearly fraudulent, because, you know, an undergraduate would know that if it's coming down in all those other countries, then clearly there are other factors operating other than swallowing fluoride. On the other hand, if they weren't aware that the World Health Organization was collecting the same data on 12-year-olds, then it shows a level of utter incompetence, which is almost inexplicable. How can you how can somebody do that, be at that level of a federal agency supposedly protecting our health, and not be aware that the fact that you're plotting was being plotted by the World Health Organization in all these other countries?
When you show those two graphs,
yeah,
and then you put them on opposing pages in the book,
yeah.
When you show those two graphs to people, how do they generally react? I mean, because it seems
they're pretty shocked.
It's almost self-evident at that point, to some degree.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I got to tell you that again, one of the frustrating things here is that when I give these when I give talks to communities, by and large, the people that are pro fluoridation don't show up, and one is constantly giving these presentations to people that have already been convinced that fluoridation is a bad idea. So you're giving them more ammunition, and the same with the book. I would suspect right now that most of the people that have bought the book have been convinced already that fluoridation is a bad idea, and for them now this is a lovely toolbox, an ammunition box for them to go and wage their battles. But we had really hoped, and still hope, that the people that hitherto have not taken a position, who have kept this at arm's length, like I did for many years, will read it. That scientists, professors in chemistry, biology, environmental sciences, and health, medical schools, we hope that those people will read this book and have their eyes opened. And then I think things will change.
Why have scientists and researchers who should know the difference between causation and correlation had such difficulty making the distinction when it comes to fluoridation?
Well, I don't think that many of them get expose themselves to this argument. I mean, I think, again, it comes back to where we started, that this practice has been promoted by endorsements, by and large by endorsements. It's supposed to be okay because all these medical associations, all these dental associations, all these government agencies have said that fluoridation is good. And who are we to disagree? I mean, do you really think that all these organizations don't know what they're talking about, that they would deliberately harm us? And no, this is the kind of thing that you're told all the time. And things like, hey, if this is causing any problems, we'd know about it by now. It's been going on for 60 years. If there was any harm, we would know about it by now. And these people wouldn't deliberately do this to us, would they? I mean, these kind of things are sort of common sense things, but when you scrutinize them, and you realize that practically no significant health studies have been attempted in 60 years, and none of the basic things. I mean, again, you've probably read this, but one of the things which is extraordinarily absent is using dental fluorosis as an obvious non-invasive biomarker for assessing how much fluoride a kid's been exposed to, and then using that as one axis to look at every conceivable thing that fluoride might be causing in a young person, like increased bone fractures, increased lowered IQ, lowered thyroid function, lowered earlier onset of puberty, many, many things that could be looked at in kids as a function of dental fluorosis. And think about it. We have millions of children in the United States, millions in every category of dental fluorosis, from no dental fluorosis to very mild, to moderate, to severe. And now, with such a gigantic population to choose from, you could control for every factor that you could, every confounding factor that you could think of. But you've got this delicious, non-invasive biomarker. You don't have to draw blood. You don't have to analyze bone. It's just there. It's visible. And the dentists have this expertise to tell you which category the child is in, and then you plot whatever factor that you're looking at against that. And they did that in Mexico, and wow, what did they find? They found a linear increase in bone fractures in children and adults as a function of the severity of dental fluorosis.
Meaning your exposure to fluoride over time creates brittle bones?
Possibly, yeah, or it interferes in some way with bone formation, which weakens the bone, whatever. Yeah, that's the implication. But, I mean, they used that methodology and found a pretty striking effect. But, again, when it came to looking at that, the promoters just dismissed the methodology and have not attempted to repeat that.
Could you briefly describe the factors that you think are responsible for the startling decline in dental caries over the past century, since that's the primary evidence used by supporters of fluoridation?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. I don't think it's a clear cut. I think there are many possible factors. I'll go through some of the ones I'm familiar with in the literature. One, of course, is the obvious one, and that is that topical fluoride may reduce tooth decay. And I think it's highly plausible from a biological point of view that fluoride is hardening the surface of the enamel and makes it more resistant to acid attack. So the fact that fluoridated toothpaste is now universally available could possibly be one of the big factors. Another factor is when income levels go up, a lot of things happen. When income levels go up, children tend to get better diets. Parents tend to have more time to, you know, look after the kids. They have more money for preventive dental treatments and so on. So income levels are very important. Diet is a very important one, and it's quite possible that we're going to find that the early declines in tooth decay, the early when fluoridation first began, it coincided with a step up in school meal programs, with free milk free milk at schools, fortification of food with vitamin D. Vitamin D is really critical for both teeth and bone formation, calcium metabolism. So I don't think that's been scrutinized as much as possible. Now, related to that is pollution. Surprising enough, as pollution decreases, sunshine levels increase. I mean, the amount of sunshine that people get increases. And that would also increase the production of vitamin D in the skin. So that's another factor. Yet another factor is antibiotics in food, processed food. Has antibiotics, chemicals added to the food to fight bacteria. And these two may have worked, just as fluoridated toothpaste is an antibacterial agent. I mean, fluoridated toothpaste at 1,000 parts per million plus will kill bacteria, will kill the bacteria which causes, you know, the production of, the conversion of sugar to acids. So, if fluoride can do that, then maybe these other antibiotics can do that. So, you know, there are quite a number of factors there. But income levels, diet, I think that whole business of vitamin D is a big one, and topical availability of topical fluoride.
In 1999 and 2001, the CDC concluded that the benefits of fluoride were topical.
Yes, predominantly topical. Yeah.
Why hasn't that taken hold?
That's a good question. I mean, if I think of two places where fluoridation should have stopped in recent times, one was 1999 when the CDC admitted that the major benefits, the predominant benefits were topical. I mean, I think a rational person would say, well, wait a moment, if it works topically, you don't have to swallow it. Why are you exposing every tissue in the body to a known toxic substance and also exposing people that don't want it when those that do want it can have the more rational approach of brushing it on their teeth and spitting it out? I mean, that was the rational position at that point, say, well, this is a good time then to get off this thing. Whoops, we made a mistake. We got the mechanism wrong. For 50 years we thought, and then they say that, for 50 years we thought that the kid had to swallow the stuff before their permanent teeth had erupted, and by the time when the teeth erupted, their enamel was stronger and so on. Oops, no, wrong. That was a t- time they should have backed out. I think the second time they should have backed out was when the National Research Council reported all these endpoints which clearly don't have an adequate margin of safety. I mean, if you look at the, what you have to do if you're doing a risk assessment, which is what the EPA should have been doing, and for some reason after 4.5 years has not been able to do it. Remember, the ADA apparently was able to do it in 1 day, and the CDC was able to do it in 6 days, because they came out and said, essentially, the NRC report was not relevant to water fluoridation. For that statement to have been scientific, they would have had to have done a risk assessment, determine what the new safe, what the MCLG should be, and then clearly shown a big gap between that new MCLG and the one part per million that they're using in fluoridated water. Of course, they can't possibly do that. And they couldn't possibly have done that in 1 day or 6 days, but apparently after 4.5 years, the EPA still has not been able to do that. Again, assuming that science is operating here and not politics. And I think it's politics. I don't think the EPA has what it takes to stand up to the Department of Health and Human Services and pull the rug out of this sacred practice.
The politics issue gets to, I think, the thing, some of the challenge you have in the book, which is if fluoridation is based on such shoddy science, and if it has provides marginal, if any, benefit, and if it poses health risks, how in the hell has this persisted in the absence of good science?
That's good.
And,
good question.
And you know, you're careful not to ascribe any grand conspiracy to it, but it's
right.
Frankly incredible that if the things you're saying are true, that we still have this. And it's almost like you have, aren't you obligated to provide some sort of narrative that explains how this happens?
Well, fortunately for us, I think Chris Bryson did a brilliant job of providing the narrative of why it came about. I mean, he provides the narrative of the industrial interest that had a huge interest in changing the image of fluoride from the worst air pollutant to the pollutant that had caused more damage to agriculture than any other air pollutant, and was creating all kinds of lawsuits and all kinds of problems for industry, many industries, World War II, post-World War II. And he explains that for them it was a very convenient, that water fluoridation was a very convenient way of obfuscating these dangers of this air pollution, not only from the environment to the environment, but to the workers in these plants. So I think that's one thing. It's something that he does not discuss in his book, which we do discuss, and that was the role of Big Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And Big Sugar said in 1949, 1 year before the mysterious, scientifically mysterious endorsement of fluoridation by the U.S. Public Health Service, we need to find a way to reduce sugar decay without reducing sugar. And then continued to put a lot of money into people like Fred Stair and other, you know, big name nutritionists to promote the benefits of sugar, and also, of course, of fluoridation. So, you know, I think if you look at the beginning, then you can find the interest, the economic interests that were part of this whole launch of the practice. I think it's much more difficult today. I certainly think the ADA has liabilities and senses it has liabilities if it admits a single health effect other than dental fluorosis. I think they know that means that there are going to be lawsuits. So they can't admit it, just as they can't admit that mercury into the mouth causes any health problems. So they have to say it doesn't happen. But I think...
Worked well for the tobacco industry too, didn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think it's more for, the way I see it is that they have been absolutely brilliant keeping your dentists, your doctors and scientists away from the literature. That's been the crunch, that there has been no inspection. Don't expect lots and lots of scientists to be utterly puzzled about why this has continued, because most of them simply have not exposed themselves to the arguments that are in our book. And fingers crossed, a year from now, hopefully many more will have been exposed to it, and then I think you will get the kind of reaction that we would anticipate now. You know, you just said, well, why is it that the people are allowed to continue with all this evidence? And as I say, I think that doctors, the run-of-the-mill doctor and dentist, is so busy running their practice and making a lot of money that they don't have time to read the ins and outs of this. So they rely on the professional bodies. The professional bodies, at the same time, rely on these big federal agencies to give them the warning signals that there's something that they should look into. But then you find this absolutely bizarre that nobody's in charge of this thing. The FDA has not regulated fluoridation, doesn't regulate fluoride for ingestion. So that's a big, big absence of federal oversight. You find that the EPA does not regulate additives to water, only contaminants. So it's only an indirect involvement with fluoridation, and when they are asked to pursue that indirect involvement, they're obviously backing off. They won't you know, kick this practice in the crutch. And then you've got the CDC, and there I think that most people, when they hear the word CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they are thinking in terms of this big body, what, with 20,000 employees down Atlanta, which is looking after our health, blah, 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 and have no idea that really what we're talking about is the Oral Health Division, which is only about 30 people. And when you look at their qualifications, they're nearly all dental, and basically the CDC is tweedledum to ADA's tweedledee. So the ADA and the CDC are essentially the same entity when it comes to fluoridation. They both promote it, and neither has the scientific expertise in the safety issues to really make not that they're going to be objective about it. And that's the problem. I don't think people realize that the CDC, in this instance, is a biased entity with a conflict of interest. Their job, the Oral Health Division, is to promote fluoridation. And it's extremely interesting that we now have three instances where the ADA does something today, and a few days later the CDC does it. And the first one was when probably previous examples, but in my recent history, the NRC comes out with their report March the 22nd, 2006, and on the day it's issued, the ADA says it's irrelevant to water fluoridation. It took the CDC 6 days to then more or less repeat the same announcement that fluoridation, the NRC report is consistent with their promotion of fluoridation at one part per million. And then, around the clock a little bit later in 2006, the ADA puts out its EGRAM recommending to dentists, but not to parents, that the parents should not use fluoridated tap water to make up baby formula. And a few days later, the CDC comes out with a watered-down version of the same thing. And then most recently, we had on our webpage our latest campaign, which is to at least let's do something that we all agree upon. Let's get this warning to parents. If you live in a fluoridated community, don't use fluoridated tap water to make up baby formula. The ADA says that, the CDC says that, we say that. They say that because they're a little bit concerned about dental fluorosis. We say that, A, because we think parents should be warned, and B, we think it could be more serious than that. So we all agree upon that. So we've launched a campaign to try to get water departments around the country and legislators, state legislators, to pass legislation in different states telling the water departments to do just that. Anyway, so what we get, we get an email from the ADA, a letter from the ADA saying, please take our logo off your websites. You have our ADA logo, and by the way, you've got to correct the quote. The quote is not accurate. Well, it was actually accurate, but it was a question of which statement it referred to. referred to. A few days later, we get the same thing. The CDC says you've got our logo on your website. Take it off and correct the statement. And in each case, we've done what they've asked. But I find it interesting. They seem to be more interested in protecting this logo than they are in protecting the health of the American public. Because the real issue here is why they can issue an important statement which pertains to children, babies, and not take very strong steps to make sure that parents get warned about it, which they're not doing.
Are you seeing any progress? Have you seen communities or states that have stopped fluoridation?
Well, we've seen many communities stop fluoridation, and many more reject it, that where they've tried to put it in. It's a slow business. There's no indication that any developed country that has not fluoridated water is about to start. We're down to a very small percentage of the world's population drinking fluoridated water, and that's been fairly stationary. I think the place to look for is going to be Canada. We had just recently Waterloo and Kitchener vote in a referendum to stop fluoridation after about 40-odd years. They've been fluoridated, I think, since 63. They voted to stop. We've had other large cities in Ontario also stop, like Dryden, and the three cities in the Niagara region, and many other cities are discussing it right now. And you've got to put that in the context that Quebec City stopped, and that's left only about 3% of the whole of Quebec is fluoridated. And Kamloops, British Columbia, stopped, and only a very small percentage now of British Columbia is fluoridated. So Canada is being squeezed down more or less to maybe two or three provinces in the middle. You've got Alberta, Manitoba, or is it Manitoba? I think it's Manitoba, and Ontario. About the only significance of fluoridation left in Canada. And I think the writing is on the wall for Canada. And I think when Canada stops, or when a big, either Toronto or Ottawa stops, that will be, I think, the end for Canada. And I think the U.S. will continue to brazen this out, but I think Canada stopping will have quite an influence on Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland, and possibly England. So, yeah, I think things are moving in our direction and will continue to move in that way. I mean, the first thing which was really important, the thing that has changed since we started 14 years ago is the advent of the internet in big time, as far as activists are concerned, the use of internet by activists, the use of emails, the use of web pages, and now with Facebook and all those other things which I have no idea how to use, but other people do, I think more and more people. Once someone says, I think this is an issue I should look into, wow, then we've got a chance. And most people are saying the same kind of thing that you've said. You know, why on earth has this gone on for so long? Why? If it's all these things you said. So we've basically got three things going, Jeff, on our webpage, which are incredibly important. One is the 28-minute videotape where you've got 15 scientists, including some big hitters like Sir Ian Chalmers in the UK, three members of the National Research Council, two former employees of the EPA, former president of the International Society for Doctors for the Environment, some dentists and doctors and others, explaining in very simple terms why fluoridation is a bad idea. That's a 28-minute videotape, and that's been watched by a lot of people already. So that's important. And secondly is the professional statement. It's now been signed by over 3,200 professionals, doctors, and dentists, and others around the world. So we're slowly making inroads into the number of professionals who are prepared to come out publicly. I think for everyone that comes out, there's probably 10 others that agree with us, but have seen what has happened to colleagues when they've come out and are frightened of doing so. Now, we're told all the time by dentists, you know, I agree with you, but there's no way I can come out publicly. But gradually, they are, and we'll reach a tipping point when it will be easier to come out than not to come out, which is what we're hoping for. And, of course, the third thing is our book. So all of those are trying to demolish this standard approach, which is all the people with white coats says that fluoridation is safe and effective, and all the people that say it's a bad idea are a bunch of Looney Tunes. So we have those three things out there to convince the public that that's not the case. And, you know, I think a 28-minute videotape is easier to watch than to read our book, but for those who want chapter and verse, it's there.
If you live in a fluoridated community, what are the least expensive alternatives to drinking the water? Are there commercial...
It's darn difficult. It's very, very difficult. I mean, we faced this problem for 7.5 years. It took us 7.5 years before we finally got fluoride out of the village of Canton. And whilst we were doing that, it was very frustrating. We used to buy these 5-gallon jugs of water from a big, you know, big place, which is pretty cheap. And we had a water tower, and we used that water for drinking and cooking. But we were also bathing in it and showering in it. And the thing that upset my wife a lot was that she was watering her garden with it, you know, and she's grown organic vegetables for 25 years. Not a speck of pesticide has ever been added to our garden, and yet here she was spraying this fluoridated water onto the vegetables and so on. She was very upset about that. And then, so we're protecting ourselves at home to a certain extent, not completely, but to a certain extent. And then when you go downtown to a restaurant, you've got to worry about every glass of water you get, every cup of coffee that you drink, every cup of tea, every meal that you eat has been made with fluoridated water. And then when you go to work, again, same thing. You're drinking fluoridated water. You're drinking coffee made out of fluoridated water. When you go to a friend's house, if they haven't done the same thing as you, it's the same thing. So it's very, very difficult to escape fluoride by these personal efforts. If someone was to say to me, as they often do, what's the best way to protect myself? I say now, distill water. Use distilled water, but for goodness sake, if you use distilled water for drinking and cooking, make sure you are buttressing that approach with a package of minerals. I believe you can get them from health food stores. In other words, minerals designed to make up for the fact that you're drinking distilled water as opposed to the water with the, you know, the calcium and the magnesium, all those other good things in there. But that, to me, is the only certain way, absolutely cast iron method of avoiding fluoride in the water, because unfortunately in the United States there is no requirement that bottled water contains the fluoride content or any mineral content for that matter. Only if they've deliberately added fluoride to the water are they required to indicate what the fluoride levels are. But if it's not deliberately added, there's no requirement, which is different from Canada and Europe. You get a bottle of water in a restaurant in Canada or Europe, you go to the back of the label and you can find out how much fluoride you're getting. Can't do that in the United States.